Good evening and welcome to Screen Tone Club, episode 2, recorded on the 22nd of July 2018. It's still boiling! It's very boiling, Andy. Please help.
Yes, yeah, I've spent a couple of days in London this last week, which made me appreciate how much less boiling it is up in Glasgow. I mean, less so in terms of temperature, it's just the humidity that's the killer. Kind of like up here, the one saving grace is even when it's hot, it's not too humid. Like it's kind of, it's a sort of dryish heat. But then going down to London just reminded me of what a sweat-soaked nightmare that place is when it's particularly hot, especially once crowded underground trains are involved. So, not my favourite thing to do is kick around on a London underground train when the temperature's like 38 degrees.
Oh, God, don't. Oh. Yeah, I was in London earlier in the week for a comedy show and I sort of looked at the two changes I have to make on the underground to get where I was going and I thought, nah, I'll just walk for 45 minutes. Fuck it. Like, that's probably more bearable although still hot. So that's the bargain I made with myself. Anyway, this podcast is not about the weather, although let's face it, we are already fulfilling our obligation of being British by talking about the weather. And this is a fortnightly look at manga with a focus on joint discussion. My name is Elliot Page, podcast host, and joining me is Mr. Andy Hanley, as you have already heard, he of the 38 degrees tube pencil metal tube nonsense heat.
Yes, I have survived. The sole thing that kept me going is I must do this podcast. I must survive till Sunday evening. And here I am. I made it.
Oh, man, I'm so glad I've made a lifeline instead of just a silly radio show. As a quick note, thank you to those who reached out about the first episode. Podcasts start and finish all the time. And it was nice to have some positive feedback on episode 1. We're still working on it. More stuff to come. More places for it to turn up. And I'll be more about that in the close down. Let's talk about what we're talking about this fortnight. So first and foremost, we have Andy's pick, which is The Promised Neverland, Volume 1. So Andy, why don't you go ahead and, why'd you pick this and, what do you think of it?
Yeah, so I picked this, as I mentioned on the previous episode, because this is one of those series that I've heard people talking a lot about in hushed tones, but always in very vague hushed tones. Like there are some series where people just kind of go out there and say you should read this because XXX and Y, and you know, that's kind of, it's usually easy for me to get a feel from that in terms of like, oh yeah, I'm going to enjoy this or I'm not. But The Promised Neverland is one of those weird series where people just like, oh, this is really good, and never kind of extrapolate beyond that. And kind of now I've read the first volume, I can kind of see why in a sense. I will endeavor to kind of give a bit of a synopsis without hopefully giving too much away, although it is kind of tricky.
I mean, so, the series itself kind of goes through a lot of things, gives a lot of stuff away really quickly. So
yeah, that's kind of the surprising part about it. Yeah, I kind of thought maybe one of the reasons people were talking about it in the way they were was that it was a very slow burn, but actually it's in that kind of that good sort of shonen manga tradition where it hits the ground running pretty quickly. But basically, in terms of a synopsis, the series is set in an orphanage called Gracefield House, within which there are a whole bunch, I think it's like 38 or something, kids of various ages who are all kind of rocking around. Obviously, they're all without parents, they're all orphans, but they seem to be having a pretty good time. Like, they have a pretty enjoyable, kind of easygoing life for the most part, of just kind of, you know, spending time together, running, playing in the fields, etc., etc. Except the one kind of oddity in their everyday life is that they have to do these various kind of intelligence tests every day, which is one of the really good early things in this first volume, is it does this really good hard cuts from kind of like happy, like, yay, it's breakfast time, we're all just eating good food and like enjoying each other's company, through to this far more kind of, menacing is not really the word, but there's kind of like a dark feel to how this turns to this very kind of regimented testing that all these kids are having to do for their intelligence. And so that's kind of like the first little hint, or one of the first little hints, that something's not quite right with this scenario. There's something behind all this kind of like happy family in inverted commas life. And of course, being an orphanage, you kind of expect that kids will come and go from said orphanage. So, you know, the series follows kind of basically a trio of the oldest characters, or the oldest individuals in this orphanage. Emma is the main character, and then there's Ray and Norman, who are also kind of an equivalent age. I think they're all like 12 years old. They're also the three smartest kids in the group as well. So they've kind of gotten used to like seeing some of the younger members of this orphanage kind of go away, as they assume to get new parents. You know, they've been found foster homes and they're going off out into the world. So great, happy times. Except, of course, that's where the twist is, because circumstances contrive for them to visit one of the few forbidden places in their world. Like, they're not allowed across like the fences and the gates that are kind of the boundaries of this orphanage. And there is this one particular gate that they're told to stay well away from. But they have a need, as far as they're concerned, to visit it, as one of the kids is leaving the orphanage. And of course, they come across a shocking discovery that completely changes their worldview and their realization of what's going on and why they're in an orphanage and basically what their purpose in life is, you could say. At which point the series kind of turns into a cat and mouse game, because Emma et al. And these three brightest kids eventually all just realize that they have to get out of this place. Like, there is bad times afoot for them if they don't get a move on and find a way to escape. But at the same time, it becomes increasingly clear that escape is not going to be easy, that their mother, as they see it, is kind of already onto the case, that something is awry and that somebody has found out something that they shouldn't in this orphanage. And so the game is afoot between the group that are trying to get out and the powers that be, as it were, that are trying to stop them, which is basically, I kind of thought this was maybe going to be over with quite quickly and that the end of volume one would be them escaping into the big wide world. But it looks like the cat and mouse game continues. I don't know for how long. I'm actually curious to read more and find out now, because it's very much, by the time you reach the end of this first volume, it's very much an escalation of that. Mm. And I will say, I really enjoyed it. Like, for me, I guess if I had to kind of be comparative about it, there's kind of an Attack on Titan-esque feel to the world once you start to see what's actually going on. Like, there's, you know, that sort of similarity of an enclosed world that there's sort of no escape from. And there's the kind of the oppressive nature of being in this relatively confined space from which it seems like there's no way out. And from within which, it, as it turns out, you know, there's plenty of menace and malice within those walls as well. And then that's kind of tempered with a side of, I know, the likes of kind of Death Note and Code Geass, where you've got this kind of cat and mouse game between these various clearly kind of smart factions who are trying to outsmart one another to try and get the upper hand. And it's kind of like, it's two things that I kind of enjoy melded together in a really entertaining and engaging way. Like, it certainly, it hooked me in pretty quick and it did not let me go until the end of the volume. And as mentioned, I'm kind of on board to read more of it to see where it heads now.
Yeah, totally. I'm right there with you. Especially like right from the get go, like from page three, basically, you know, something is up. Like, this is too idyllic to last. And like the first, I mean, like it lets you in on the actual main twist, quote unquote, the first twist of many, on page 42 of the first volume. It's just like, hey, check it out. Like, this is what's happening. And it really, like, the one thing, it's really smart about the cycle, about the information it gives you and what that means and how the characters process it and how you process it. And you come up with questions. And then two pages later, the characters ask that question. And you're like, oh, this is awesome. This is really smart. Like, and like, it throws in some really good like wrenches in the works, and it knows when to upset the apple cart, as it were, because you get these amazing moments and two-page spreads where it's just like, oh, you thought things were this way. Actually, the story is already two steps ahead of you, and now the characters have to curse their powerlessness as they are. One thing it also reminded me of, and maybe this is just my sign, but it also reminded me of the animated claymation film Chicken Run. Because that has some of the same ideas, I suppose, of like enclosed world, how do we get out, oh no, we're going, yeah, etc. So I don't know, that's maybe not an anime thing, but I'm totally with you on the Death Note part. But yeah, it's fascinating. Like I say, it's really smart in how it cycles through the various loops of discovery and tension, and the three smart kids, and they're all the three smartest kids, you know, Emma, Norman and Ray, they're all smart in different ways, and they all very clearly are going to have differences of opinion and conflicts. And, you know, Emma is a hilarious idealist of the Shonen Jump mold, and it's already become clear that someone's going to have to give something up at some point. But yeah, it's really amazing. And also, the one thing that I have been constantly having to readjust is the scope of the actual thing they're stuck within. Like the actual, like, how big is the apparatus that they are part of? Like how big is their prison almost? Like, is there another wall beyond? Who's actually on their side? Is anyone on their side? What does everyone involve? And like it teases all this stuff out really smart. And as you say, like, you know, it's all, you know, from the get-go, something is wrong, but the scale of it kind of dumbfounds both you and the characters themselves kind of at every turn, which is fascinating to read.
Yeah.
So that's been really fun. Like, it's like, to use a rather benighted term, but it's a real page turner. Like, whoa, you know, you start reading it and you go, oh man, you know, I was burning through it and I ended up missing today's Formula One race because I was so engrossed in it. So there you go.
Yeah. I kind of had a similar experience that, you know, I normally kind of sit down and read this stuff in the morning when I get up at the weekend. And it's one of those times where it's like, I'm hungry. I should really go make some breakfast. But also, like, I'm only halfway through this volume and I'm going nowhere until this is finished. Like, my stomach can wait because this is more important. So I definitely had a similar feeling with that. But yeah, I think you've hit on a couple of good points there, because I think the way the series kind of makes you feel smart is kind of really well done, because there are some series that, you know, just telegraph everything in a way that is very unsatisfying. And there are some series that kind of throw its twists in such a way that you can never really piece it together yourself. And it never really feels very satisfying because it just feels like it comes out of nowhere. This manages to split the difference because, like you say, it gives you just enough clues and just enough rope that a few pages before it happens, you're like, oh, this is a problem, or, you know, this is an obstacle that was unforeseen. And then, like you say, a few pages later, the characters get clued in on that. And, you know, it gives you just that little feeling of like, yeah, I saw that coming, but like not in a really obvious way. And it just, it makes you feel good about the process of reading and the fact that, you know, you were kind of half a step ahead there. And yeah, I think the other thing is absolutely like the overall scope of the world as a whole. Like, as well as just wanting these characters to escape, I also just want them to get out into the big wide world, because I want to see what the heck is going on beyond the walls of this orphanage. And it's very good at kind of really giving you little to nothing to go on in terms of like what they're going to find if and when they escape from this thing. And like, that's one of the things that absolutely has me wanting to read more, because like I want to know what they're going to find, assuming they manage to make it out of this crazy situation they're currently in. And, you know, there aren't many series that kind of that do that with the sort of the bravery and the flourishes that this series does. Like, it would be so easy to drop in a bunch of kind of hints. Like, if you like Attack on Titan, kind of, it doesn't manage to hold its nerve all that long in terms of like, hey, what is there outside the walls? Like, it very quickly goes and sort of starts to fill you in on that stuff. Whereas this feels like it holds its nerve and is just like, nah, I'll show you in good time, maybe, or maybe not. You'll have to wait and see. And I do like that. That's definitely keeping me hooked in to want to read more of it.
Yeah, one of the things that really helps with that is that the characters kind of know their powerlessness, and they are completely within an enclosed environment, and so even the things they have available to them are limited, and so they have to extrapolate from there. And you as the reader might have a little more, because you get the like panopticon view of the manga reader, and that just means that whatever small snippets of extra information and inferences you can make, like, I was like, at the very end of the volume, there's a thing that happens with Mum, and I gobbled that down immediately. I'm like, what does this mean? What does this mean? Like, it's fascinating. Like, it's really gripping. Like, at one point early on in the volume, I was actually quite scared that they were going to burn through all the mysteries. And I was like, oh man, are they just burning through this entire series really fast? And then it's going to plateau bad. And maybe it will. I don't know. I hope not. But like, in this first volume, it's held its nerve so well. It's kind of ridiculous. But yeah, like it's just very careful in how it drops you hints. Like a character will say something, and you're like, oh, that means, yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And I really like Emma. Like, as a main character, she is like the Shonen Jump, like spunk and enthusiasm. And she's got like really cool hair that's like mega ahoge and really cool sort of layered hair. The art's really good. I'll more on that in a second. But like, Emma is a really fascinating character because she's this idealistic one who is like stamping her foot saying like, no, we'll get all of us out. And it's like, oh, Emma. But yeah, she's great. I love her as a main character. Like,
yeah.
And it's so good that her main strength and her main weakness is her sheer compassion, which is lovely. Like, it's so nice to have a character who's like willing to like grind their teeth to paste to see her friends alive.
Yeah, and I do feel, though, that that character wouldn't work if it weren't for Rain Norman there as well to kind of, like, give you the three kind of edges of that particular triangle.
Oh, certainly, I feel like
Emma on her own would probably be infuriating, but then you've kind of got... is it kind of like Norman that's the kind of really quite bookish one? Who's just like total Mr. kind of pragmatist of like, no, like, you need to stop thinking about anything other than yourselves.
So and that's then there's Ray.
Kind of, okay, that's right. And then Norman's kind of somewhere in between the two. Like, he's still way more pragmatic, but he's also like, well, you know, he cares about Emma and about the others enough to be like, okay, well, maybe we can compromise somewhere in the middle. Like, those two characters just balance things out really nicely.
Yeah, the second character, I forget his name. Connor? No. Gordon? No. What's the second character's name? The blonde one?
Norman.
Norman, sorry. It ended in awe. But yeah, I think he's a fascinating character because he is such an amazing counterweight between everyone else. Like, when I'm talking to Emma, he is almost a counterweight to whoever he talks to. Like, he's kind of milquetoast and bland on his own. But that's what makes him really fascinating because he's like, yes, Emma's plan has problems, but I would like to see it happen. And it's like, okay, dude, like... good for you. One thing I want to touch on quickly is the art. And one thing it does in particular that forgive me for saying this, because once I notice say this, you're going to notice it all the time, because I certainly did. But it does an amazing wide-angled lens, fisheye lens thing, where it will bend the edges of like the image, like when you see 360-degree images, and it bends environments around. But it's not like there for the hell of it. It's there to show you the scope of the room in like a two-page spread or in this thing, and it's really fascinating. Like, it's got this very gentle curve to the world that is showing you, and everything is well placed, like nothing looks awkward, and it really lends itself to some fascinating sort of views. Like, the first time you see the testing center is like boof, and it's like, oh, that's I don't like this anymore. So it's really powerful at doing that. The art is really good. Like, the I don't know how they have time to draw this like weekly, because holy cow, some of the detail, especially in the first chapter, is like ridiculous. Really, really amazing use of shadow and like textures and layers. I mean, there's quite a few sort of like mob characters that are like, yeah, you know, you are like children, you know, 3 through 36 or whatever, but they all look cool. So, but yeah, it gets it really good on the art front in that regard. Like, just... and like there's a two-page spread early on. I think it's like page 45 and 46, like after the first reveal, which is like actually kind of like spooked me quite a lot because it's so abrupt. It's like, whoa, okay. So yeah, it's really powerful. Like, when it wants to pull out a howitzer, it will totally shoot you with it in the art department.
Yeah, totally. Like, I will admit, like, to start with, I wasn't a big fan of the character designs. I was like, I'm not sure if this really kind of works for me. But as I got into the volume and started to see how they were using those designs and how it fitted in with the wider art style, like, I was totally turned around on that. Because, yeah, like, I think the way this volume manages to kind of juxtapose things, and like you say, you have these kind of like hard cuts to from kind of pretty idyllic visuals to something far more kind of claustrophobic and intimidating and downright spooky sometimes. It manages to turn things from this kind of, you know, these what should be kind of wonderful open vistas, and suddenly it all feels really claustrophobic and really malicious and malevolent. And, you know, when it comes to depicting the sort of the darker stuff in this volume, like, it doesn't hesitate or skip a beat. It just goes there. And, like, it really does a good job of kind of taking the tone wherever it needs to go. And if that means like a hard kind of 180 from like Happy Fun Times to the exact opposite of Happy Fun Times, like it's willing to do it and it always makes that work.
Yeah, it does some really good use. Like, again, there's another point, like halfway through the volume, when just there's an actual jump scare in the manga, and I nearly dropped my tablet. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, I felt so stupid, but it's like, oh God, like, oh, but yeah, it's really, yeah, like, I really enjoyed it. And quite honestly, I'm probably going to pick up the rest on after this podcast, because I didn't want to read ahead and be that asshole, although I am usually the one who does it, saying, oh, I've read more. Like, I'm going to read more, though, because, oh, I really enjoyed it. Like, kind of ridiculous. I am slightly scared that it's already in 10 volumes in Japan, so it's a Shonen Jump manga, so of course it's going to go a bit long, but I just hope it doesn't outstay its welcome or like miss its ending point, as it were, because I've seen that happen too many times. I mean, manga sometimes isn't good at ending. So, but I have faith in it at this point. Like, at this point, I'll give it all the rope I can. So there is that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I were it not for this podcast, I would probably have gone and like read ahead through future volumes as well. But yeah, like, I too did not want to be that asshole and thought, no, let's like keep it to volume one for now, and I'll sit on my hands for a bit. But yeah, like, definitely on the rope to read some more of this thing, because I can see where all the hype has come from now, and it all makes perfect sense.
And it also makes sense why everyone was so quiet about it, because of course you would be. Like, I already feel a bit bad that we've kind of talked this much about it in this recording, but it was great. Like, and I really encourage people to read it if you fancy it at all. So yeah, man, good pick, Andy. Good job.
Yes, yeah, I was glad. I felt it was going to go one of two ways, and it went the better of the two ways. So I'll take the credit for that one.
Cool. So coming down from that, I suppose, really, is Perfect World Volume 1, which is not about dystopia this time. It is about a pair of old childhood sweethearts, well, kind of childhood friends, acquaintances, Ayukawa and Mokana, who are reunited in a works mix party. They're both grown up. They're both mid-20s. They're getting on with their careers. Wakana is the female of the pair. She is a interior designer. And Ayukawa used to be the basketball team ace, and is now training and working at being an architect, which is cool, honestly. And it kind of goes from there when, at the mixer, it turns out that Ayukawa has a spinal cord injury and is wheelchair bound and is basically paralyzed from just above the hips down. And it's a Jose sort of romance tale. And for this first volume, the two of them mostly just sort of hang out a lot and slowly kind of get comfortable with seeing each other again after like nearly a decade of not seeing each other, and slowly just kind of feeling out each other's comfort zones, and in particular Ayukawa's various travails, like his real life problems of being wheelchair bound and being paralyzed. And I really like this series, and I picked it to do this because I'd already read it by the time I picked it for this podcast, but I wanted to have someone else talk to about it. Given that I quite enjoy, like, it's not maudlin. Like, it'd be the easiest thing in the world to be like maudlin, or just to throw a Wikipedia based page of facts at you about the thing that's currently going, the characters are going on with. But it manages to tease out like enough education and also enough interesting storylines to really kind of like make it feel really worth digging into these characters and seeing their relationship. And it's also grown up in how it presents it. It isn't like they're in high school still and they see each other every day and everything's the end of the world. Like, they've both adults. They've both got careers to get on with. Like, it feels slightly disconnected as a whole, because, you know, they got careers and lives to get on with, and the times they see each other are few and far between, even though they work semi-closely. So it's like, you know, it has like a slightly ephemeral scrapbookish feel of a manga where various things just sort of slot into place. Like, oh, we went to the cinema. Oh, we saw someone else. Oh, we did this. Like, it all kind of picks together there. And that's kind of one of the reasons I like it, is it does feel very much more adult, and there's very frank discussions about some of the problems and just disabilities and discrimination against disabled people in just daily sort of issues. And it kind of doesn't labor it, but it does take time out in the paneling to say, hey, look, steps are a pain in the ass. Who would have thought? So But that's why I kind of like it. And by the end of the first chapter, the first volume, and this is not really a spoiler because you can see it coming from like page two, is they agree to get together and tentatively pursue a relationship. But God knows what that's going to entail for both of them, given that especially Ayakawa has quite a few hang-ups, but you kind of can't blame him given what's happened. One of the nice things about this volume is you have a different sort of storyline with another kid who's recently had an injury, a spine injury, and it's all about sort of disability acceptance. And it goes about that, again, in a very pragmatic, very sort of adult way of like, hey, I ain't got all the answers. I don't like this either. So, you know, it's a really good read on that regard. But yeah, I really quite enjoy this manga. I've got volume two already downloaded because I bought it in the sale. I haven't gotten to it yet because, again, podcast. But I've kind of just gone along on this in a slightly unstructured fashion. So what do you think of it, Andy?
Yeah, so I was kind of a little bit torn on this overall. Like, I guess my biggest issue that kind of plagued me throughout this volume was that I never really bought into the idea that Ayakawa and Kawana liked each other. Like, there are moments early on in this volume where they kind of flash back to their high school days of like, oh yeah, like this is how it used to be like when, you know, they hung out as teenagers. And it mostly just seems to be kind of Ayakawa being a bit of a jerk to Kawana and her kind of being like ambivalent in return. So I was never really bought into the idea that, oh yeah, like she totally had a crush on him in high school, because the relationship never really felt like it worked in that sense. And that kind of followed through to, you know, when they sort of meet and start hanging out together a bunch, because the first volume sort of has a moment where it basically just says, oh yeah, we just started going out places a lot. And it picks sort of one example where they go to see a movie, which is, you know, pretty normal fare. And again, like, the volume does a good job of like looking at some of the disability issues around that, but it was also a point where like it felt like it could have sold me again on kind of the relationship and even just the friendship between these two, whereas it kind of all felt very sort of, it was just flat. Kind of there. Yeah, it was just kind of flat. And
yeah, I buy that. I can see that, definitely.
And it kind of like, in a way, I would rather this story have been about kind of two people of whatever gender or whatever, just kind of like being friends and kind of, you know, having the disability angle through that. Because as it stands, it kind of felt a little bit like a book that was, it felt like the author wanted to write a book about kind of living with disability first and foremost, and then bolted the love story stuff onto it, which is not necessarily a bad thing in itself. And as you mentioned, like the discussion of the sort of issues around disability and kind of the practicalities and the realities of it are all really well done. And I think there's actually like a proper like research credit in the end of the book, which shows that, you know, they've done their homework and just not like pulled this stuff off of some whatever stories they've pulled off of the internet. Like, you know, there's proper thought and research and you know, there's a genuine kind of authenticity that runs through it all. And all of that stuff is really interesting. But it felt like that would all have been equally interesting without the romance element that always feels like it's kind of been super glued onto the side of the rest of things, which is maybe a bit harsh on my side, but that was kind of like my main takeaway from it. Like, I'm sold on the topic at hand, but the love story is just not, I just don't buy it, basically.
No, I can see that, definitely. I mean, yeah, I think it definitely, it's a case where it's a very good, interesting story with Ayakawa, and Wakana has ended up somehow becoming the vehicle for telling this, which is bizarre, because also one of the problems with that is that even the romance aspects are more about Wakana and her own reactions and her constantly questioning herself and her own analyses and it being her point of view, which makes it strange because it's not really a natural interaction as such. It's more just Wakana thinking about herself, doing things. And it's all very in her world sort of thing, even though Ayakawa is the far more interesting character. Well, interesting is a bit mean, but you know what I mean? Like, interesting as in like there's much more to see there, but it's a strange thing in that regard. I think you're definitely right in there where, yeah, the romance kind of just happens because it almost seems like it's like, oh, there's got to be a romance here. It's like, does there? Well, I guess there does, sugar. So, yeah, it's a strange combo.
Yeah, like I feel like the only kind of place where that works, and this is a little bit of a spoiler as a forewarning, but like, you know, there's a whole kind of story arc around Ayakawa's like previous relationship that started before his spinal cord injury, and like that was the one point where I like that works really well, and that was actually quite powerful in places, and that was a point that kind of made the other interactions between characters work, but that was kind of like, it almost felt like it fell into that out of kind of, you know, pure luck, when the rest of the volume seemed to be struggling with kind of you know, selling me on the relationship angle.
Yeah, that one part that I got when I first read it, and how again you've brought to service, is that I almost want to see that storyline more. Like, I would like to see, like, it sounds mean and a bit cruel and a bit sort of suffering, porny, but I'd like to see the previous relationship and how it collapsed, and how that gave rise to the current state of Ayukawa, which, again, sounds mean, but that's probably the more interesting storyline to, like, dig into, and probably is a bit more sort of applied and a bit more dynamic between the two of them. Yeah, it's strange. I agree with you, although I still kind of like it. Like, I like this series mostly as it handles itself very well, and that's kind of what I mean, maybe it's just me having a low bar and expecting the worst, which is perhaps damning with faint praise, but I did enjoy it. It's an interesting story, and also it handles something that I've not read before well. I would like to, I had a look online, and I couldn't find like a review or analysis by someone in the same situation, and I'd be fascinated to read that. If that was available, if you have found something like that, please point me towards it, because I'd love to see how it stacks up against real experience, even though I think that this is a sort of case where no two experiences are exactly the same with this kind of admittedly kind of awful injury.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was kind of one of the things that I found myself pondering as well, is like, you know, like I say, it's clearly been researched, but yeah, it would be interesting to see how that sits with somebody who's kind of, you know, who's been through that situation themselves, be it directly or indirectly. Because yeah, it certainly, it seems like it's very kind of upfront about all of that stuff. Like it doesn't hide anything away, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that is to its credit. It doesn't feel like it's just cherry picking the bits of kind of living with a disability like that are good for the story, or kind of salacious, if you like, for the story. Like, it would be so easy to go for the low hanging fruit there, but it feels like it's taking like a breadth of that experience, you know, from the mundane stuff through to the kind of, you know, the far more terrifying stuff, quite frankly, you know, the kind of things that you can't imagine anybody having to live with. And I feel like it does a really good job of that, and that's certainly the side that, you know, for all of my criticisms of the romance side, like you, I found that side of things about, you know, talking about living with disability and you know, the practicalities of it, and you know, the mental toll that it can take, you know, I found all of that really fascinating, and it certainly felt like it was coming from the right place there. And it was also interesting, you know, as both of us live in the UK, to kind of get a bit of a feel for like how things are different in Japan compared to the UK. And again, that would be interesting to hear a more kind of overt comparison of, because, you know, I suspect, you know, for all the difficulties of living with a disability, you know, that requires a wheelchair in the UK, it feels like Japan would be a whole lot rougher in that regard. That seems to ring true from what this volume was putting down. But again, yeah, that would also be an interesting kind of comparison point that I found myself sort of sitting there pondering, having read this volume.
Yeah, if that piece exists, let us know, and we will link to it for sure. Like, I definitely want to read that. But yeah, talking about things not being salacious, Andy, you don't find incontinence salacious? Weird.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are other manga that covers that stuff in more in very different ways, I suspect. But
I'm vetoing I'm vetoing that for the podcast. No. Oh, lordy. But yeah, I might carry on with it. I would like to, it sounds really mean, but I'd love to carry on with it if it was shorter, but it is currently ongoing in Japan and is at 7 volumes, which is on my sort of tipping point of, this looks a little long. So in terms of, you know, financial commitment, quite frankly. So I'm not sure, I've already got volume 2 on the hook, but I'm not sure about continuing past there.
Yeah, that seems fair. I mean, yeah, that does seem like a lot for that particular story. But yeah, maybe it finds a lot to dig into with it. But yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see sort of how it continues and where it goes. So yeah, maybe at some point we shall have to have a brief kind of catch up on some of these series in terms of like later volumes and what they're like.
Yeah, I'm down for you if you are. Cool. So that was Perfect World. So moving on, what we're talking about next time. So we're both nominating a series or volume with a one-liner reason why we're picking it. So for me, I'm picking 5 Centimeters per Second, which is the manga adaptation of the Makoto Shinkai film. I've heard it ends better than that film does, which is not exactly hard to do. But I'm curious because I've owned this and had the physical version and then lost it in a house move and then bought it for like £2 on a digital sale. So now I've got the entire thing ready to go. So that's my pick. And for you, Andy?
Yeah, for me, I have picked the manga adaptation, because admittedly, I was not aware that this was based off of a light novel, but the manga adaptation of So I'm a Spider, So What?, which is a series that I don't really know a huge amount about, but again, it's definitely a series that people have talked to me about in reasonably glowing terms. I feel like even you've mentioned it to me at least once, but I could be putting words into your mouth there. But people have definitely said things of a positive nature about this to me, and although it doesn't sound from the title like my kind of thing, you know, I'm curious, so I'm gonna give it a shot.
I'm not sure I've said anything about this beyond that title's funny. I don't know.
I mean, that's enough for me. That will sell me on a manga. Like, yeah, you're right. The title's funny. I'll read that.
Yeah, if there's a funny face on the cover, I'm totally buying it. I must admit, both this and I was reincarnated as a slime have both been recommended by people I trust greatly and who, like, do not suffer garbage, who have said, oh, this is good. I'm like, are you high? And they're like, no, Elliot, shut up. I'm like, oh, okay. So, yeah, I've had this mentioned to me as positive, in a positive light. Cool, so those are our picks for next time. If you fancy, feel free to read along and send us your questions or comments or thoughts, or if you've already read them, go ahead. So a little quick side note thing of what's coming up in the world of manga in the next 2 weeks. First and foremost, a backfill element is that Land of the Lustrous Volume 6 came out last week. I picked up immediately as soon as it came out and devoured it whole on the bus. Land of the Lustrous remains possibly my favorite series going at the moment, like bar none. I love that series dearly, even if it makes me sad because it's kind of a suffering journey. But oh man, I love the entire cast and... oh man, and now I finally understand where that goddamn fan art's coming from that was really spoilerific without me knowing why. So thanks, Pixiv.
Yeah, I feel like I keep thinking about picking that up because, you know, I adored the anime adaptation, which I know goes some different routes to the source material. Yeah, like in the Anime Limited office, we have the Land of the Lustrous art book from the manga author, which is also like a thing of beauty that kind of made me think I should probably start on this at some point, but I haven't done so yet, so maybe now is the time.
I would highly, highly recommend it, but I've already said it's one of my favorite things, so of course I'd say that. I also bought that art book, Pseudomorph of Love, and man, I think I mentioned it on Twitter, but man, the cover is way more like porny than I was expecting. Like, woof.
Yeah, that was one of those, like, it was handed to me in the office. I'm like, what have you bought? And it's like, oh, it's this. Okay, well, I guess that's fine then. But yeah, I know where you're coming from there.
Yeah, it's like, is this? I mean, they're all genderless, so whatever, fine. So yeah, I love that series. Also coming out in 2 days' time on the 24th is The Voynich Hotel, which is a manga by Daoman Seiman, who typically did a bunch of really quite stark black and white only doujin that often were kind of creepy, cute and gross. And Voynich Hotel is actually legitimately licensed, translated and released. And like, you're probably not going to see something this weird for a while. Like, people thought Frankenfran was never going to come out, and it did somehow. And now so is Voynich Hotel. I recommend at the very least looking at a preview of it and picking it up if you fancy, because it's fascinating. That the author's mindset is gnarly, but it's really fascinating a series. I previously have read it in a not quite so legal fashion. But yeah, Daoman Seiman is, if nothing, if not fascinating, a creator. Not everyone's cup of tea, I'll admit. Even not my cup of tea half the time. But
yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the preview for this on Bookwalker, and I am possibly sold on this. This looks really interesting. So yeah, I'm squirreling this away in my brain as a thing.
I mean, if you were all the way sold on it, I'd be slightly worried about you because it is pretty sort of woof. Oh dear. And finally, I think to mention, if only because of the hilarious name, which was already big when it was an anime, is World End. What do you do at the end of the world? Are you busy? Will you save us? Volume 1, the light novel. Although this is probably a heavy novel because of how frigging long the title is. I'm kind of surprised it hasn't broken Bookwalker's website because that's a long title.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd like to think if Bookwalker was prepared for one thing, it was ridiculously long titles, because, you know, dealing in the content they are, you know you're going to have to deal with that problem at some point. So a fair play that they were prepared.
When they were building out that database, they looked at the database and said, like, oh, no, make the title field a big string. Like, you know, make it a big string. So, yeah, good old, a little bit of PHP gags for you there. MySQL, even. Anyway, and also one thing to note, although it ends very soon as we record, is there's an ongoing Shonen Jump sale on Comixology with basically all Shonen Jump manga half off. I wish it was all Viz stuff because I'd buy a whole bucket more stuff, but I already weakened and rebought all of Claymore because I had half of that physically and then had to stop because it was too long. And now I have 27 volumes of Claymore on my tablet. So yeah, oops. But it was half the price it would have been normally. So that's okay, I guess. Shrug. So, but yeah, that. But one thing to note, of course, there was the previously ongoing Amazon strike for Prime Day. So maybe think about that a little bit before you press the buy button. I tried, although self-evident that I was weak. So just bear that in mind. But yeah, that's. Unless there's anything else coming out you want to shout out, Andy?
No. I was just looking through the release schedule. There is nothing particularly that tickles my fancy. I see there's more Nozaki King coming, but you know everybody knows that's awesome already, so I probably don't need to say anything about that.
Yeah, I think we could probably just do an episode where we both go just recite our favorite gags and talk about how good it was.
Yeah, to be fair, like I'm way behind with reading that manga. I should probably
so
catch
good,
up
dude.
On that because yeah, I every time like every time I see a new volume comes out, like they probably run out of good things, and then I see people like posting panels and things from it is like, oh no, it's still good. I should probably catch up.
One of my favorite new through lines in that series is Nozaki's lazy ass brother, Mayu. It's such a good subplot, man. I'm not going to say a word, but it's so funny. I love it so much. Also, volume 10 going out in Japan and it has Kashima in it. And it's like, oh, that's adorable. Oh, God, love that series. Anyway, so we've been going for a wee bit and I think that's about all we've got time for. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Screen Tone Club, episode 2. You can find our website at screentone.club. Now I fixed the DNS records and it redirects properly. The podcast can be found directly on the website. There's an RSS feed on the website, which will let you put it in your podcatcher. We're on Apple Podcasts, which was a pain in the rear, let me tell you. We're on Spotify as well, so that's cool. I haven't got a Spotify account, so I haven't been able to confirm it. And we're also looking at putting ourselves in more places as I plow through the various submission procedures and forms and such. We're not on Google Play Music, however, because they don't offer podcasts in the UK for some reason. So
yeah, it's amazing they still haven't fixed that, because that's one of those like, oh, we're just launching it in the US, but we'll have other countries available soon. And soon was quite a while ago. And yeah, still no bones. So our plan for everything everywhere has been thwarted thus far.
Andy! So yeah, but yeah, when it is available, we'll do it. If you know of any other venues, let us know and we'll put it on there. As a quick note and a beg, because we've got to do this, if you do like this podcast, please tell a friend. It's probably the easiest way of increasing our readership, listenership even. Tweet about it. That's greatly appreciated. If you have any thoughts on the episode, please drop us a line. If you use a podcatcher or Apple Music or whatever, if you could leave a rating or a review, those are massive and really helpful, because even one review really helps with their algorithm of how they display things. But yeah, well, that'd be really greatly appreciated. We don't have a Twitter feed yet. I'm going to set that up at some point. As a quick note for personal plugs, I'm Elliot. You can find my stuff on moash.it. Not much on there at the moment because I'm still working on fixing it. And Andy?
Yep, you can find me on Twitter at Hannahs1979.
Oh yeah, I'm on Twitter as well at Elliot Page when I'm not temporarily banned for saying mean things to Elon Musk.
How dare you question his submarine? It would have been great.
Dude, it was legit the longest 12 hours of my life because I couldn't favorite cat tweets. It was hell.
Yeah, I think that is the true dystopian nightmare of being banned from Twitter and not being able to look at the cats.
Yeah, what else is there? Anyway, so thank you very much for listening. Have a lovely evening.
Bye, everyone.